It's good to see all of you this morning. Appreciate your interest in being a part of our Bible study from the Psalms. I hope that the Psalms, the study of the Psalms, is beneficial and encouraging and helpful to all of us. Not a lot of times do folks study just simply from the Psalms, but we're happy to be able to do that and hope that it's helpful. In our study this morning, we're in Psalms 125. I hope to finish that just shortly. And then talk about some things from Psalms 11. But in Psalm 125, notice if you will, it says, "They that trust in Jehovah are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abideth forever, as the mountains are round about Jerusalem." So Jehovah is round about his people from this time forth and forevermore. "For the scepter of wickedness shall not rest upon the lot of the righteous, that the righteous put not forth his hands unto iniquity. Do good, O Jehovah, unto those who are good, and to them that are upright in thy hearts," or in their hearts rather, "but as for such as turn aside unto the crooked ways, Jehovah will lead them forth with the workers of iniquity. Peace be upon Israel." This passage, as we have noted in our previous study, introducing some of these thoughts, is a song of ascent, a psalm of ascent, going up to the city of Jerusalem as they saw the grandeur of the city, the grandeur of the temple, and the occasion that would bring them there. And so as we were studying last time, the mountains round about it symbolized the protection of God's holy city. Now, in our study so far, we've looked at verses 1 and 2 and noted the comparison of these verses and tried to present from the illustrations we have around here as we look at the mountains, in particular as you travel up toward Mount Whitney, or some of you have been to Pikes Peak and things of that nature, and see that folks look up out the mountain and see the majesty of it, and some, I suppose, even worship the mountains as some kind of a god. But this is the image that we want to see, that the people who would come to the city of Jerusalem to worship, they would see the grandeur of the mountain, the grandeur of the temple, and the things that pertained to that. And of course, the comparison that we've tried to make in the Hebrew study on Tuesday night is what those Hebrews have become a part of. They've not come to something physical, but rather they have come to the church of the living God that's described as the kingdom in verse 28, which cannot be shaken. And that's what Daniel prophesied was to come to pass. We're familiar with all of that. So as we note in this passage, he says, "The scepter of wickedness shall not rest upon the lot of the righteous, that the righteous put not forth their hands unto iniquity." We talked about that the scepter or the rod is a symbol of rulership, and rulership of wickedness doesn't rest upon those who are wicked. And we talked about that, and we saw from Psalms 37, Asaph's confusion about how that he looked at the wicked and they seemed to be blessed, and he looked at the righteous and himself in particular and didn't seem to be quite as fortunate, and he didn't understand it until he went into the house of the Lord. And that's the lesson that we want to take home. Now that's what we got studied in our last study. I want to pursue just a little bit of that in verse 4 of Psalm 125. "Do good, O Jehovah, unto those that are good, and to them that are upright in their hearts." Now, that's stated as a request of the psalmist to do good to those who are trying to do right. And the point being, let them be under your divine protection. And, of course, we have to consider that in light of who we are as we read from the Psalms and make similar requests, that God will bless us with the things that we need. I have on the board Matthew chapter 12, beginning in verse 43. I want to turn to that and look at it just briefly. In verse 43, you'll recognize the context of this. Verse 43, "But the unclean spirit, when he is gone out of the man, passeth through waterless places, seeking rest, findeth it not. Then he saith, I will return into my house whence I came out, And when he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. And he goeth, or then goeth he, and taketh with him seven other spirits more evil than himself. And they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man becometh worse than the first. Even so shall it be also unto this evil generation. Now, what's the point that we're trying to make? The psalmist says to God, a request of God, to do good to them that are upright in heart. Now, those who are upright in heart, what are they going to do with those things that are bad? This is the point we've established over and over again. What do you want to do with things in your life that are not good? You want to stay away from them. You want to repent of those things. But now, if you just stop doing the thing that's bad and don't start doing the things that are good, what's going to ultimately happen?
You go back to
bad. Well, you're going to go back to the way that you were. And so the point being in this request is for God to do good to them that are trying to do good and help them in that endeavor. And so we see it formed somewhat like a prayer, as it were. In verse 5, he said, "But as for such as turn aside unto their crooked ways, Jehovah will lead them forth with the work of iniquity. Peace be upon Israel." That kind of ends the point. But what is the point? For those that turn aside to wicked ways. Now, this is a point we've established over and over and over and over again when we talk about the doctrine of Calvinism, in particular, the once saved, always saved position, the possibility of returning to the things that you were. And what did Peter say about that in 2 Peter chapter 2? Well, what did he say about it? Pardon me? Like a dog going to his own vomit again, the sow that had washed, wallowing in the mire. This is not good. So Jehovah will lead them forth with the workers of iniquity. Those who do evil things, here is I hate to call it a category, but here these are grouped together. You do evil things, you're going to meet with the destiny of those who do evil things. And that's the point. So those who go away from the Lord, they meet with destruction. How many passages can you think of in the New Testament that teach the same thing as Peter did? What was the ultimate end of those that Paul writes in the Galatian letter who had tried to implement one thing from the law, that is circumcision? Unless you be circumcised, you can't be saved. And what was the consequence of that? Just one thing.
To even go beyond circumcision.
Well, yeah. If you're going to do that, then you have to implement the whole law. And if you do that, you're falling from grace. So here you go. Grace is what saves us. And if you fall from grace by adding just one thing, then what's your state? You're lost. You go the way of the workers of iniquity. And this gets us back, Randy, to Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 23. And you see on the board these passages. In Ezekiel chapter 33, perhaps a familiar text to some of you, what does Ezekiel say regarding those who pursue this path of iniquity? What about the good that they do? There's not any good. It won't be remembered. Not even the good that they do. If you pursue a course of iniquity, then that's what God will remember. The good that's accomplished will not be remembered. And of course, we see the same thing as we mentioned in Matthew 7. We see it again in Matthew 25. As you read in that text implying judgment, and certainly so as you get to verse 31 of Matthew 25. Any questions or comments just here? This last statement is important, especially as you consider the context of premillennialism. And you say, well, why? I want you to look at this last statement, "Peace be upon Israel." Now, we've established in numerous studies in times gone by, contained in the law of Moses. Moses said, you do what God says, what's God going to do? He'll bless you. And we see this in Deuteronomy 28 through 30. If you don't do what God says, what's God going to do? God's going to curse you. And again, same context. We call it the blessings and the curses of Deuteronomy. Now, we see that amplified over and over and over and over and over in the history of Israel, especially during the period of about 305 years of the Judges. And we've talked about that circle that they go around the horn about 15 times during the period of the judges. And we frequently raise the question, how many times does it take to learn that valuable lesson? And even this week was talking with somebody about Uzzah. How that Uzzah, you recall, put up his hand to steady the ark the Ark of the Covenant when the oxen stumbled. You remember the text, both Isaiah and I believe it's 2 Chronicles record that. But what we want to note in that is David said, because we didn't seek God according to the law, this is what happened. We were not successful, and Uzzah was smitten dead. I want to suggest to you another thought on that in our discussion with somebody. I've forgotten now exactly who it was. Might have been Bruce and some I met for breakfast the other day. That's beside the point. But the point being is, why did Uzzah feel so emboldened to put up his hand and steady the ark? You say, well, he knew the value of the ark. He knew what it represented. And he didn't want to see it fall. And I suggest to you there's some reasons that go beyond that. Who was Uzzah? For those of you that are kind of into the Old Testament history, into that. Who was Uzzah?
He was the son of the owner of the property they were taking.
That's right. He was the son of Abinadab. Yeah. And his brother, Ohi, was present on that occasion, too. They were kind of in charge of the thing. And so how long, perhaps, had the ark been in the house of Abinadab? You remember when the Philistines took it?
I think it was at least 20 years.
Yeah, at least 20 years. Well, that gives us a kind of time to grow up with the Ark of the Covenant right here in my house. Now, if you had something like that in your house for 20 years, you grew up with it, would you not consider it with familiarity?
Oh, and Abinadab was blessed because the ark was with his...
Oh, yeah, as opposed to the Philistines. Yes. Now, the point being is that I'm trying to establish here is that Uzzah was likely emboldened to reach up and steady it because he was familiar. 20 years. It had lost its...
Getting a reverence for it anymore.
Yeah, that's the word I'm searching for. It had lost its reverence in his mind. And so... When we look at this, we see that peace shall be upon Israel. But as we look at the Old Testament Israel, it was the Israel that served God and was faithful to God. But there's a New Testament application of this as we come over into the book of Galatians. And we need to see that because that's the point of contrast that the Apostle Paul is making, that you don't go back and keep the law, because if you go back and keep part of it, you're obligated to keep all of it. But then in the last part of his writing in the Galatian letter, he says in verse 16, "And as many as shall walk by this rule, peace be upon them and mercy and upon the Israel of God." Now here's a term that we're looking at in our text. Peace be upon Israel, the Israel of God. Who would that be?
Us.
Yeah. The Israel of God. So this real peace that we're talking about is upon the people of God who do what God says. And that includes you. Now we could amplify the point with several of these other passages, and you're welcome to look at them. They all teach essentially the same point that we're looking at in Galatians 6. But I think you see that. Peace be upon the Israel of God. What can we learn as we look at this Old Testament text of Psalm 125? As the people of Israel would ascend to the temple site, it was an occasion of great splendor and grandeur as they would approach the temple and those things that were associated with that. But for those who would not, those who were workers of iniquity, then there would be their just reward that God would secure upon them. But peace be upon the Israel of God. And who is that? That's the people who do what God says. Simple point, isn't it? Again, if you're talking to a premillennialist and all he can see is the Israel of God of Old Testament, those who are Jews, he missed the point. Because the point Paul is making in the New Testament book of Galatians is the Israel of God is the church. Okay. Any questions or comments on that? I know I went through that rather hurriedly, but... if you have a question or comment, I'd be happy to consider it and would appreciate your input.
No?
Well, I was talking with somebody recently, and they said that a Bible class teacher that just stands before a group of people and lectures, that's not the best kind of teacher to be. I don't want to be that kind of teacher. So if you've got some input, I'd appreciate you speaking up, Carolyn.
I do have one thought. You mentioned Psalm 25. As they go up to Jerusalem, we talked about, you can see it from a distance. You're sort of starting to prepare yourself. And we should do the same for our worship time. It should be a revered time, and we should be in the right frame of mind.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm glad you brought that up. That gives me an opportunity to make a point that I think is important. Or make your point. It's a very important point. Sometimes, Richard and I were talking just before services, we get delayed for something that makes us rush. You ever have to rush to get something done? And you get caught in that trap when something happens. We rush. And sometimes that becomes a habit. One of the elders in Piggott told me one time, we had a family there, they was always late. They was rushing all the time to do anything. They was always late. And he asked me, he said, "Do you know why people are habitually late?" I said, "No, I don't guess I ever thought about it." He said, "The reason is they don't start on time." And he said, "I'm not talking about they don't leave home on time. They don't start the day on time." Now, you know how long it takes to get from your house to the building, right? Now, if you wait till it's starting time for the class or starting time for worship to leave your house, what are you going to be?
Late.
All right. Now, you know how long it takes you to get ready? All right. So if you wait until it's time to leave your house to start getting ready, what are you going to be? Late. Okay. So now you can back that thing all the way up to what time do you get up? Now that's where that is. I remember when the girls were little. Carolyn, I don't mean to just elaborate extensively on it, but it's a valuable point. When the girls were little, we were rushing and rushing and rushing to get to the building on time. And I told them that don't do. We're going to leave at this time. This is what time we leave. We ought not have to rush to leave at this time, because this is how long it takes to get to the building. We want to be there in time to sit down and get our thoughts collected. And so if we leave at this time, we can do that. Now, in order to leave at this time, what has to be done?
Get up.
You have to get up. Okay. Now, we're going to leave at this time. And that's just the way it is. So we're going to back up the time that I wake you up 15 minutes. Okay, so I'll give you 15 more minutes to get ready so we can leave on time. And if that don't work, I'm going to back it up 15 more minutes. And if that don't work, I'm going to back it up 15 more minutes. I said, now I get up at 5. You see where I'm going with this? Now, if we can't get up and leave and be there on time, I can get you up at 5. Well, no, I don't want to get up. Take your bath the night before, so you've got things ready, you see. All you've got to do is put your clothes on and have your breakfast, and we're out the door. See, nothing to that, right? Sounds simple. But in order to do that, we've got to start on time. That's a valuable point. Do we do that with our work? Do we rush? Well, no, we understand the importance of that. We couldn't keep a job if we did that, you see. But sometimes we don't think about that when it comes to our worship. Now, these Jews, granted, they did this about once a year. But it was a great, great occasion. And so our coming to worship, should it not be a great occasion? Something that we look forward to and make plans toward so we can be here to worship the Lord. Great point. Great point. I didn't think of that in reference to this text, but that's a great point. All right. Any other thoughts or comments there?
The first verse, those who trust in the Lord are like Mount Zion, that you're going to be like a rock. Mount Zion was there when you were a kid, and 50 years later, it hadn't changed. But the point there is that those who trust in the Lord, if we were to poll everyone here, do you trust in the Lord? I think we'd get an absolute yes from everyone. But there's trust and there's trust. The stories told, illustrations given, of a guy walking along a cliff, and he happened to slip, fall over, but he was able to grab a tree growing out, sapling growing out of the side of the cliff, and stop himself from falling. So he's yelling, "Help, help. Is somebody there? Help." And all of a sudden, out of the nowhere, this voice comes and it says, "Let go." And the guy stops and he pauses and he says, "Is anybody else up there?"
Yeah.
So often, that's what God tells us. I'm in control of your life. Do you really trust me to take care of you? God says, I need you to obey me along these lines, to do this and not that. And so often we wind up saying, on all of those, we will wind up saying, is there anybody else there? And we don't really trust. There's a part of me that says that I must confess, it's a lifelong process of becoming to where you can trust the Lord more and more. But that's not an excuse. But it is something that we all need to work on to get to where we trust the Lord more and more in every aspect of our lives.
Yes. And I appreciate your comment on that. Connect trust and believing what God says. The two go together, just hand in hand. So trust then becomes a very essential element of faith. You believe what God says. It's disturbing to me sometimes, our mindset about what faith is all about. We kind of have this idea. Claire, go ahead. Go ahead. I didn't see.
What he was saying brought up something. Recently, in the last couple of months, I've had occasion to go through things, and I'll say, I don't know what to do. I said, trust in the Lord. I said, okay. And then I have to keep saying it. Because if it goes along and I think it's swinging the wrong way, I want to change it.
Yeah.
But if you have to trust in the Lord, it'll work out.
It will, and sometimes the decisions, they become a little clearer with the passing of time. Remembering somebody that was very anxious about their life toward the end, and they were concerned about going into an assisted living facility or staying in their home, and they were really anxious about some of these things. And I said, you know, don't worry about it. Some of those decisions along life's way, they eventually get made for us. And I believe that's so, and the person was able to have somebody live with them for a while, and they died at home, so they didn't have to go into an assisted living facility. They really had a dread of that, and so there you go. But you're right. Our element of trust and believing what God said, they go together. When Paul was on that ship and was about to be shipwrecked, and you recall the response of the others who were on the ship, they wanted to get the lifeboats out and so forth, and were preparing to do so, and Paul said, wait just a minute. Saw an angel of the Lord told me that if you want to live, you stay on the ship. And I believe God. Now what did the other folks then who believed what Paul said, what did they do?
Cut the boat away.
Cut the lifeboats away. Cut the ropes. Let them go. There's trust, isn't it? I think that's it.
I just want to say that before we move on to the next one, verse 2 to me is a really comforting verse. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forever. That's a permanent state.
Yeah.
Permanent state from the time you obey the gospel until forever. That means past death. So through the transition of death into eternity, this is the way it is. When you choose to serve God, he surrounds you in the same way that the mountains surround Jerusalem.
Yeah. I'm glad you trust it, or you preface that with trust. That's verse 1.
Yeah, but that's the... I think a companion verse is Romans 8:28.
Yeah.
We know that all that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God.
He's in control. Hmm. Yeah, he's in control. All right, very good. Any other thoughts or comments? I appreciate all that you had to say. Well, turn, if you will, now to Psalms 11. I know we're going back toward the beginning. But the Psalms are not necessarily written in a chronological order. And we've talked about that already when we introduced our study. Psalms 11. I've been kind of excited about studying with you this Psalm. So we'll start by reading it. And Randy, if you would do your usual good job, I'd appreciate you reading the text for us.
Okay. Psalm number 11. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? Behold, the wicked bend the bow. They make ready the arrow upon the string to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain snares. Fire and brimstone and burning wind will be at the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. The upright will behold his face.
Isn't that a grand psalm? That just sets the stage. Now, I don't know when David wrote this psalm. It's attributed to David in the preface up at the top of the chapter or the psalm. But I don't know when in David's life that he wrote this psalm. Some say, well, perhaps it was during the time in which Saul was pursuing him. Well, perhaps. I don't know. Others suggest, go ahead.
Absalom.
That it was during the time when Absalom was pursuing him. And we don't know. But the dilemma that he expresses is applicable to either of those times. And the lesson is timeless. And we want to talk about the lesson of this psalm. So, in Jehovah do I take refuge. You read it, it's all good. But at verse 3 is the kind of the key question that's answered in the chapter. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And there's all kinds of folks trying to answer that question, aren't they? If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? And there are those who suggest a number of things. But it presents a very vivid dilemma. What do you do when everything seems to be falling apart at the seams? Well, let's look at what some said. Some said, well, what we need to do is we just need to run. Well, no, that won't work. And this was the problem. David's friends, if you please, are telling him, you need to run. So, in Jehovah, he said, do I take refuge? Now, how do you say, verse 1, flee as a bird to your mountains? How do you say that? That's a legitimate question. How do you say that? Run. You ever felt that way? When things weren't going well, well, just run.
What they would probably be encouraging David to do is abandon Jehovah and be like Saul or be like Absalom.
Yeah, but that's not a logical solution to the problem. But that's what David's advisors, I call them friends, but that's what they're telling him to do. You need to just run. Well, that really don't solve the problem. And so then, on the other hand, there's some who say, well, there's not anything you can do. The wicked are going to destroy you, and so that's the end gate, so you've got to flee. Well, David didn't see it quite like that. David saw that he had some other options available, and we want to see what that is. So what do you do when the foundations are apparently being destroyed? What can the righteous do? And I think the answer, as you read, Randy, is seen in verses 4 through verse 7, and that becomes kind of the key points that we want to look at, because is calamity going to come in your life? Yeah, things are not always going to be pleasant. And so then what do you do? Well, we want to talk about that. Number one, as we look at these answers that David gives in this passage, number one, realize where God is. God sits on his heavenly throne and he sees everything that occurs. Look at verse 4. Jehovah is in his holy temple. Jehovah, his throne, is in heaven. And his eyes, behold, his eyelids try the children of men. Does anything escape God? No. No. Now, when we look back at Psalm 73 last week and we talked about Asaph, see, this was the problem that Asaph was having. He looked at the unrighteous man and he seemed to prosper, and he looked at his own life and he didn't seem to see that he was blessed at all. He just, things got worse and worse and worse. He tried to serve the Lord. So the question becomes overwhelmingly apparent. Where are you when I'm suffering? Well, where is he when you're suffering? Pardon me? He's still there. Yeah. The Hebrew writer tells us, I won't ever fail you. And I won't ever forsake you. Still there. As long as you trust in me. You keep trusting in me. Now, he's in his holy temple. Jehovah, his throne, is in heaven. He sees it all. Now, this was a problem to Habakkuk, wasn't it? Remember that text? When Habakkuk raises the question and he looks at the evil that the people of Judah are doing. These are all familiar things to this class. He looks at the evil that the people of Judah were doing, and he raised the question, God, how long are you going to let this go on? And God says, I'm going to tell you, but you wouldn't believe me if I did tell you. I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans, the Babylonians, and they're going to take these people into captivity. And there, they're going to learn not to serve idols. I don't want to oversimplify this, but Habakkuk's response essentially was, how can you do that? Why, they're worse than we are. And God said, don't you worry yourself about that. Now, this makes a very loose paraphrase. Don't you worry yourself about that. I got a plan for the Chaldeans, too. You see, I'm going to raise up the Medes and the Persians, and I'm going to take care of the Chaldeans. Now, what was it that Habakkuk learned from all of that? That exchange that he had with God over the condition of the people. What did he learn about where God is?
He's in charge.
And so what then was his conclusion? I just need to be quiet. I just need to be quiet. Now, brethren, we need to see that, because that's alluded to, in fact, it's quoted in the New Testament. And for a long time, I studied this passage from Romans 1, 16 and 17, memorized the text like many of us do. And that little expression, but the righteous shall live by faith. Now, we're familiar with the text of Romans 1. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God and the salvation. You're familiar with that. Contained in the gospel is God's message of salvation. So, the righteous live by faith. Now, where's that come from? Habakkuk chapter 2. And Habakkuk just had to learn that God's in his holy temple, and I just need to sit back and be quiet. Because the righteous, as Randy was pointing out a while ago, live by faith, and that combines believing what God said with trusting Him to do what He said. Now, even though Habakkuk didn't have it all figured out, and his mind is still perplexed and in a dilemma as to how that the Babylonians are going to serve any useful purpose, as evil as they are, God had it all figured out. And so, Habakkuk, what do you do?
Trust.
Now, brethren, I want to suggest to you, that's not always easy. And as you, Randy, so ably pointed out, that's a lifelong project. Because we kind of go up and down on that scale, don't we? Depending on what circumstance of life we're in. And to be constant, trusting what God has said, that's not always easy. Now, we've got on the board Job chapter 23. Job had to learn this lesson too, and he had to learn it the hard way. And I love studying from Job, thanks to Chris Simmons. Well, I love studying it before, but Chris helped me with some preparation of some material that proved to be very, I'll say preparation, basically organization of some material presented in a gospel meeting that I was asked to speak in. Chris kept telling me, he said, I think you can do this. I think you can. I don't think I can. Five lessons. We got 40 and some odd chapters here. I don't know if I can do that. So, but I did. And when you look at Job's thoughts in chapter 3, where was Job when he met with the dilemmas of life? The perplexities. The difficulty. Where was Job when all this befell him. What did he want to do, Job chapter 3? What did he wish for himself?
He wanted to crawl into a hole and pull
it. You've been listening. Yes, that's exactly what he wanted to do. In fact, he said, I hate my life. I hate my life. I wish I was dead. I wish I had died in my mother's womb. Wish I'd never been born. Now, you can't go back and redo that, can you? That's not on the table. And so, this was Job chapter 3. But then as you turn the pages and you get over to Job chapter 9, look if you would please at verse 20. Job chapter 9, verse 20. He said, though I be righteous, mine own mouth shall condemn me. Though I be perfect, it shall prove me perverse. I am perfect, I regard not myself. I despise my life. Now he said that in chapter 7 too, in verse 16, chapter 3 as well. He said, it is all one, therefore I say, he destroyeth the perfect and the wicked. If the scourge slays suddenly, he will mock at the trials of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covereth the faces of the judges thereof. If it be not he, then who then is it? Now, who's Job talking about? All these bad things happen, and who sits on the sidelines apparently just don't care? God. That's a pretty harsh thing to say. Have you ever been there? Maybe when you felt like that? That things are not going well, and I've prayed and prayed and prayed and prayed, and things still are not going well, and so we're looking for an immediate solution, and because we don't have an immediate solution, we blame God, and sometimes we speak harshly like Job did. Now, if you keep turning the pages to the 13th chapter, you'll note in verse 3, I find this just quite interesting. Job 13, verse 3, he said, surely I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to reason with God. Now, what's Job proposing?
The New American Standard says, I desire to argue
with God. Yeah, I've got that in my margin right here. I desire to argue. What's Job want to do with God?
I'm going to tell God how.
I'm going to tell him how it is. Yeah, as we used to say in Kentucky, I'm going to tell God how the cow ate the cabbage. Yeah. All right. I want to hear him with God. I tell him. Well, and as you turn the page just a little bit further and you get over here to chapter 23, Job 23, and you drop down in that text to verse 10, the text says, but he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. You see a change in the mind of Job. Job pointing a finger at God, blaming God harshly. I want to hear him with God. I'm going to tell him how it is. And now, if God judges me harshly, it'll be like fire trying gold. I'll survive. But this demand of having a hearing with God, does that come to pass? Oh, yeah.
Chapter 38.
Yeah, God spoke in chapter 38. You want to hear him with me? All right, let me ask you some questions. When I laid the foundation of the world, where were you? Well, don't know. When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of joy of God shouted with joy. Who shut up the doors of the sea? Who did that, Job? You're so smart and you want to hear him with me? Now you got one. Answer the question. And I find it interesting how that God says that. In verse 3, he says, gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me.
I like the way Job 38 begins. The Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind and said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge?
Yeah, you don't know what you're talking about. Yeah. And after, yeah, that's right, words without, you don't know what you're saying. And sometimes that's where we are. But after God's through with Job, and we turn the pages just a little bit further over to chapter 42. Now, I'm just skimming the surface of this to make the point. Job answered and said, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be restrained. Who is this that hideth counsel without knowledge? Well, that would be Job if he'd done that. All right. He said, therefore have I uttered that which I understood not, things too wonderful for me, which I knew not. Here I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me. Who said that? God said that to him. Now Job's response. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes.
Okay.
If you get mad at God, is that a sin?
Well, would it be fair to say that Job was kind of angry with God?
Yeah, but that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, well, that's a good question to ask. No, I don't think necessarily that that's a sin right out of the chute to ask a question. But we need to answer the question. And Job got his answer to his question. Job was suffering intensely. And yes, Job was miserable. And who did he blame? He blamed God. Now, the thing that I think we need to look at concerning Job, in reference to our point here, is Job didn't know what was behind all of this. So in his ignorance, he's angry with God. He don't know what's behind all this. And of course we do. We know that it was because of what Satan did that all this terrible stuff happened to Job. So the point being is, he didn't understand. He didn't have the knowledge of it. Yes.
I think that's a really good point that you bring out, that he didn't realize what was behind, or who was behind all of his misery.
Yeah.
As humans, we have a tendency to just jump in and say, we know that God exists, we believe in God. So if I'm miserable, then God has something to do with this. And I have often, when people talk to me about, how could you let God do this? I'm like, do you believe in God? Is that correct? And they're like, yes. I said, then how do you not recognize that Satan is active? And he roams this earth freely to torture us and to tempt us, because he doesn't want to be the only one suffering for sure.
Yeah.
After all, it was through his efforts throughout history that Jesus was crucified. Through his efforts. But God turned that thing around and raised him from the dead, just according to his eternal plan. So he overrules. But yes, Jesus suffered because of Satan. God didn't do that to him. Okay?
In verse 6, Job 42:6, therefore I retract and I repent in dust and ashes. He had something to repent of.
He did. Yeah. So to your point, Claire, yes. He had charged God harshly. And he ought not to have done that.
Well, I think that the whole discussion that we're having about trust is that if you're angry with God, that shows a lack of trust. Because there's really never a good reason to be angry with God.
Yeah.
He is in control.
Yeah.
And if you trust him, then you should never be angry at him.
Yeah.
What he said. I think that answers it. Yeah. What he said. He's got that. I believe that's right. So Job was angry with God. And was he right to be angry with God? It was contingent upon he didn't understand. So can we be angry with God based on ignorance? Yeah. Now, does that justify it? No, really it doesn't, does it? It really doesn't. Because we ought to trust God in what we know he has said, not be harsh in our judgment of God because of things we may not be aware of. Now, question, you were making the point about Job that he didn't know. Did Job ever know? Well, the book of Job closes and he still don't know why all this happened to him. He never was told. But you see, his trust began to waffle at times during all of this torment. And that's what we need to take home with. The Lord rules, not men. God examines and tests those who are righteous. And that's what we see in our text of chapter 11 and in verse 5. Jehovah trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hateth. Does he try those who are trying to do what's right? And what did James say that our attitude needs to be about that? And I'll admit, before we look at it, that that's difficult for me. What did James say?
Welcome them.
Yeah. And why?
Because it produces stronger faith.
It does. Yeah. It's like gold tried by fire. It makes it purer. And that's what the trials of this life do to us. It makes us proven.
This particular song, I developed a sermon around because I'd met this fellow there in Maryland that visited with us And in talking to him, I found out that back in the 60s, he had gone into the Army, and his first assignment was at the Army camp at the Fulda Gap. Now, those of us familiar with Cold War history knows that was the point of the spear for the Russian invasion of Germany. That what was going to happen was they were just going to send division after division into that Fulda Gap to invade Europe. And everyone there really was just going to be cannon fodder. So he enlisted in the Army, found himself there at this Army base, got there, no church. So his response was, reckon the Lord needs one. And he began to work. I mean, here's this, I mean, it basically a kid. And he decides to then just to start working on building a church there. And before he left, I believe he had a church of about 30, 40 people. Now, this, to me, that was a great illustration of this particular song.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he could have walked in there and said, well, no church.
Run.
Well, nothing for me to do here.
Run.
And yes, to run. And he didn't. Yeah. And that the, as you pointed out there in verse 2, it looks like it says the wicked have the bow bent, they are ready to shoot.
Yeah.
And it's going to be in a moment.
Yeah.
It's all over.
Yeah. Yeah. Draws a vivid picture, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. So what do? Well, you run. That's the way the world thinks. But those who believe what God said don't do that. All right. Very good. Any other comments or questions? Well, did the bell ring?
For another 45 seconds.
45 whole seconds. Okay. Well, real quick then. Let's notice that God hates the wicked and the violence. You see that in verse 5. Jehovah trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hateth. And that's elaborated on in some detail. Now, New Testament text, Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18, familiar to you. God's righteousness is upon those who, or his wicked, his judgment, I should say, vengeance, is upon those who are wicked, those who are unrighteous, and those who understand that he is God but don't want to do anything about that. They don't want to serve him. And so they deny the existence of God and do other things. And we'll come back to the conclusion of this next time. The next text that we're going to is Psalms 133. That's a familiar text to you as the text begins. Behold how beautiful it is. I'm not quoting that right.
Let me
get it up there. Yeah. Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. Psalm 133, verse 1. Familiar passage. I'm quoting day to night. Yeah. Yeah.
Except
this morning. Yeah.